town, Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. Chicago is. Headline in the Washington Post reads, as of last week, at least 20 abortion cases are in the pipeline to the Supreme Court. Any one could gut Roe v. Wade. Is that true? Is this court inevitably going to overturn Roe v. Wade? And what does that mean for the legality of abortion in the United States? If you read the Washington Post piece, you get the impression that it would mean the end of legal abortion. Is that true? We're going to be talking about abortion cases possibly headed to the Supreme Court. Joining us on this Tuesday afternoon, February the 19th, Hadley Arkus. He's a regular guest. He's professor emeritus of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and several books, including Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. Hadley, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Good to be back with you.
For decades, you have been arguing that it's time for the pro-life community to take the late-term abortion infanticide equation to pro-choice advocates, to the advocates of abortion. Take that argument to them and make them respond. With President Trump's very public denouncement of infanticide in his State of the Union address, do you think that that might finally happen?
Now, first of all, it was a fine address, and he was probably more explicit on this issue than anyone since Reagan. But the curious part about it is that he didn't really take that issue to the Democrats, as the Democrats have virtually set them up for it. Remember, you mentioned our Born Alive Infants Protection Act, that very modest move to protect the child who survived the abortion, just to plant the premise that that child marked for an abortion is a human being, a person who may come within the protection of the law. A mistake had been made in stripping the penalties from that bill years ago for the sake of averting a veto from President Clinton. But now, we've heard since then, we've had far more evidence of this, more of this killing going on than even we suspected at the time. Then we had the killings going on by Dr. Gosnell in Philadelphia. And so we came back with a bill now to restore the penalties. And that brought the most illuminating, revealing breakthrough. We brought that bill to the House twice, in September 2015 and January 2018, and virtually every Democrat in the House, 177 the first time, 183 the second time, virtually every Democrat voted against the bill to punish the surgeon who kills a child who survives the abortion. And President Obama thought that bill was unconstitutional, which meant that in Obama's reading and in the understanding that now prevails among Democrats in the Congress and perhaps outside, in the understanding that prevails now among Democrats, the right to abortion articulated in Roe versus Wade is a right that extends beyond the pregnancy and entails nothing less than a right to kill a child who survives. Well, that is the point that President Trump should have made. What surprises me is that this White House, we raised this in a conversation with the White House, and they evidently were still unaware of it. It hasn't broken through to them. And Trump could speak to this very part. It is the easiest one to talk about, yet the remarkable thing is that he doesn't mention it. One thing he could have done was challenge the Democrats. In fact, I submitted some language for the State of the Union, but knowing it wasn't likely to get through. But to point out that Democrats have taken a strong position here, and now he can draw the line and challenge them to now by endorsing the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, which has been introduced anew in the Senate by Senator Sass of Nebraska, who was just lacking his sense of timing. He could have brought the bill to the floor last year with the effect of passing the bill. But instead, he wasn't paying attention. So he He brings the bill to the floor this year when we don't have any chance of passing it in the House. But the point is, the lines can be drawn. And what's remarkable to me is why the president doesn't use the clearest case where the Democrats have defined themselves sharply, because that, I think, is a winner for him and for the pro-life party in our politics now.
How do you explain the failure of, I guess in this case, it would be the Republican majority at the time in both the House and the Senate, they had the White House as well, to not act to protect a child who survives an abortion?
That's a puzzle. I saw Senator Lankford, who was helping us on this. I said, how do you explain why this bill never made it to the floor of the Senate? And he said, I don't know. Now we heard I'm afraid I have to ascribe it to the inattentiveness of Ben Sasse, who introduced the bill. There are a number of senators like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee who wanted to help us with it, but they were reluctant to act without the assent of the man who introduced the bill, Ben Sasse, but he was out busy promoting a book of his own and promoting himself. So he wasn't there to do he wasn't apparently interested in the legislative work of getting something through the Congress. But some of the things we heard was that they didn't have, well, there were other things going on. There was Obamacare, there were the taxes, but this was this bill, after all, was introduced anew at the beginning of the new year to mark the strong interest of the pro-life community. Ben Sasse had introduced it, and yet it was never brought to the floor. We heard some remarks to the effect that, well, we didn't have 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster by the Democrats. Well, if that's the case, it is all the more reason to bring it for a vote and bring it to a vote just before the midterm elections. Let every Democratic senator put himself on record as whether he was against even taking up the bill to punish the man who killed a child born alive. Now, you know, Senator Lankford remarked that now we're going to get it. We're going to have them take a position on it now. We're going to build in another week, February 25th, they're going to have a vote on it. Well, we say, well, why didn't you do it before the midterm elections so that those Democrats running in states carried by Trump would have had to declare themselves on the question of whether they really thought the right to abortion extended to take in the right to kill a child who's indecorous enough to be born alive? Why didn't you do it then? Why do you do it only now when you don't have a chance of passing the bill in the Senate? The Republicans in the House did their work, Todd. You've got to say that. You can't knock. Every Republican voted for that bill. Virtually every Democrat voted. I mean, I grew up as a youngster in the Democratic Party. That party changed dramatically. And this was one of the telling lines along which it changed. But I think it should have been done last year. And I'm afraid I ascribe it, again, not to the Republicans in the House, because they were fine. They acted decisively. They acted early. And this thing just died mainly of inattention in the Senate from people who should have been paying attention.
You were concerned about some of the inaccuracies in the Washington Post piece, at least 20 abortion cases. What were they?
It was a disingenuous piece. First of all, to pick up a point you already mentioned in your introduction, that the impression there was that the pro-lifers now would use the court to end all abortions in the United States. Well, of course, I mean, that's a canard. I don't know why people still persist in that. If the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, all it means is that we're no longer declaring some sort of a right, a constitutional right arising out of the federal Constitution for a right to abortion. It simply means that the issue is returned to the states and that extended law in New York will still be there. The laws in California, Illinois would be there. I think Mike Barone made the point even years ago that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, most people in the country would be within a one-day driving distance of a state that has the most expansive laws on abortion. The writer cited this line that most people in the country were opposed to overruling Roe v. Wade, But the figures also show that most people in the country don't know what's in it. And when you start adding the fact that this right and extends well beyond the first trimester, it runs through the entire length of the pregnancy, for virtually any reason that a pregnant woman would offer, it may extend beyond the pregnancy to include the right to kill a child who survived. The level of support for Roe versus Wade drops remarkably. I think one friend of mine, a rather savvy reader of the polls, even years ago, doped this thing out and pointed out that about 60% of people in the country were against 90% of the abortions that were permitted under Roe versus Wade, but simply didn't know what was permitted. But of course, Todd, that was exactly the point of our bill, to start with that very modest move to protect the child born alive. And the strangest part is that some of our own allies, like the late Henry Hyde, didn't see what the utility was of moving with something so modest. And so they were utterly astonished on the day the hearings opened. Listen, I testified in 2000, 2002, when we passed the bill in 2002. Our friends were astonished when the National Organization of Women and other feminist groups came out strongly in opposition to this move to protect the child born alive. And the curious part is that the other side understood that bill more accurately than our own friends, because they understood the principle that lay at the heart of the thing. They knew that we could raise the question of what is different about that same child 5 minutes earlier, 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months earlier. Give us this main point, and we can unravel your position. And that's another part of that story that was mentioned in the Washington Post, where one of the cases involves a law in Indiana that would require effect the cremation of children or require a Christian burial. And the argument is made that this is inconsistent with the due process rights of the mother of the pregnant woman. I say pregnant woman because she's obviously rejected the possibility of standing in relation to that child as a mother. But the argument is made that this is somehow inconsistent. Well, how could it be inconsistent with her, quote, due process right? She's been entirely disencumbered from it. The child is gone and dead. So the only reason they're opposing this is because it simply makes the moral point that we are dealing with human beings. It really, you know, it goes back to Lincoln on slavery, that it's you must be avowedly with these people. They take it as a deep threat. If you, quite apart from whether you're restricting the right to own slaves, whether you are whether you're calling the rightness of slavery into question, in this case, they take it as a deep threat to make a simple move of this kind about a Christian burial for the unborn child. Take this as a significant threat to women for no other reason than it makes the moral point that we're dealing with a human being, a baby. So this piece that you mentioned in the Washington Post also thought that this law in New York was so modest that it just protected a right to abortion of 24 weeks well into the point of viability, but it protected the right to abortion throughout the entire length of the pregnancy for reasons of health, which has always been understood since 1973 to encompass mental health, which means if the pregnant woman would be disturbed in any serious way by being denied the surgery, well, that would satisfy the conditions of mental health, which is why that provision has always been a ruse. So what's curious is that, you know, the writer also didn't understand or wouldn't acknowledge that the Democratic position now is, in fact, that right to abortion goes past 24 weeks, past birth, and entails nothing less than the right to kill the child who survived. The Democrats now will resist on this point. And that's what makes it even more compelling for the pro-life party to force it. This is their hardest case, as you mentioned, Todd. I mean, the hardest case for the pro-life movement was always the case of rape, and this case of rape and incest. This is the hardest position, the most embarrassing position for the pro-abortion side. This is the side that shocks people in the country when the word gets out. Now, as I said, the purpose of our bill was just to break out a lot of news that people would find shocking. But what we never anticipated was that the news wouldn't get out because the media just refused to cover it. They blacked it out. Just as people are utterly astonished when they hear about this vote twice in Congress with virtually every Democrat voting against the move to kill a child, but they haven't heard of it. Why? Why isn't that important news? Why? I was wondering why even the commentators on Fox News and the other channels, when they're interrogating, asking questions of candidates in 2016, why they never even raised this issue. There had been a vote in 2015. This issue should have been crystallized. Why didn't they ever raise it? Did they not know about it? Was the blackout so extensive that even they didn't know about it? So I think you're doing a service here by just drawing attention to the issue, but it's been one of the most baffling things for me as to how the media could be so effective in blacking out the story.
Hadley Arkus is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at American Institutions at Amherst College. We're talking with him about abortion cases possibly headed to the Supreme Court based upon a Washington Post piece outlining some of those cases. We'll be right back.
Many patients are upset to learn that doctors don't take the Hippocratic Oath anymore.
National Review columnist Wesley Smith talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
That's a real shame because the Hippocratic Oath protects patient safety. The speech I will give at the conference will describe the consequences of violating Hippocratic values in healthcare and the things that can occur in the healthcare system if we move away from Hippocratic medicine to a more utilitarian bioethics.
You can meet and hear Wesley Smith making the case for the Hippocratic Oath at the one and only 2019 Making the Case conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about abortion cases possibly headed to the Supreme Court. Hadley Arkus is our guest, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and several books including Natural Rights and The Right to Choose. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat of the New York Times, Wesley Smith of National Review, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles, and other great thinkers at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. We're only having one conference in 2019, and attendance is limited to 500. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Hadley, Clark Forsyth is quoted in the Washington Post piece. He's written extensively about Roe v. Wade as bad law, but he's commenting on the court's action since Roe v. Wade. He says that the Supreme Court has made a mess of abortion law. It's a mess only the court can fix. Do you agree?
I agree that the problem, you know, people say, well, just send it back to the states. But the problem is that the confusion came from the center. The wrong decision came from the center. People have been very sensitive to the cues given by the Supreme Court. So I think the corrective has to come from the center. Now, my own judgment of it is slightly different from Clark's. I mean, he's great willing to have Roe versus Wade just overturned right away. And when there were some moves in that direction, you saw certain people getting panicky. They're going to be divested of rights, deep rights of privacy they thought they had, and hence that move in New York to try to have a sweeping radical right to abortion out of concern that Roe was going to be overturned. I think it would be all to the good if Roe were cut back step by step for this reason. The court makes a decision, and the public will probably go along with it. Other court will say, see, it is justified. It indeed is justified to that restrict, even people call themselves pro-choice think some abortions can be restricted. So the court could say, yes, it is justified to restrict an abortion, to deny abortion because the child may be deaf, may be afflicted with Down syndrome, may be a female. And step by step, because the child has a beating heart, step by step, you bring the public to agree, see, yes, that is a justified ground for it. So getting people used to the notion of the grounds on which restrictions on this freedom to kill the unborn, the grounds on which those restrictions may be plausible, so at a certain point, you get it to the point where you can now just take a short step and say, you know, we've added it up. At every point, this position is indefensible. Let's just finally call it, say it was wrongly done in the first place. I see, when the court, the reason we're in this position now, waiting for these cases coming from the states, and not all of them really offer a direct challenge to the right to abortion. I mean, informed consent would simply say, you know, no decision taken in ignorance is a voluntary decision. It doesn't interfere with your freedom to order the abortion if you have to wait one day and view a screen of the picture of the baby you're carrying. That doesn't deny the right to your freedom to order the abortion. But what happened was, the reason we have the possibility of these cases coming up to the court is because back in 2007, when Sam Alito joined John Roberts at the Supreme Court, the court did a switch on the issue of partial birth abortion, that grisly procedure. It had struck down the bill on partial birth abortion in Nebraska. Now the court sustained the bill that barred partial birth abortion in the federal government. And what the court was saying, I think, is that we are now in business open to receiving restrictions of this kind generated within the states. And we are open now to the possibility of sustaining those restrictions. That's what I see it happening now. This, I think we're going to see far more of that. And that's actually the path that I welcome. I think it would just be useful, since it's the court more than anyone else, more any other institution, that changed the culture by creating not only a freedom to contraception, but a deep right of contraception, right of pornography, a deep right to kill an innocent child in one's own womb. The court was the leader in changing the culture, and so the court may be the leader as well in showing people anew just what the grounds were for plausible moral judgments to restrain that kind of killing. So that, I think, is the path I prefer here, Todd.
As you pointed out, most of the cases that the Washington Post describes there are about access. What do you make, with about a minute and a half here, what do you make of kind of a pincher move that would allow your moral argument to be made legally there, these modest proposals as you have described them, and at the other end, continued pressure about access, safety, those kinds of things that don't go to the moral argument of abortion.
No. But they do. They do. I mean, because one way or another, they touch the moral concern. I mean, when you're having required people to get doctors to have access to a good hospital in case anything goes wrong, I mean, you're taking seriously the possibility of preserving the life of the child who survives. No, all these things are quite plausible measures. Like the bill on, first of all, the Pain Capable Act, you know. It's curious to me that the other side has simply not responded by saying, well, why don't you just administer an anesthetic? Well, because they seem to be embarrassed, too embarrassed to acknowledge that there's a human being, a child, suffering pain. They'd rather just cover it over by invoking this abstract right of the pregnant woman to order the abortion. So, all these things, in different ways, Todd, I think, make the point that you're dealing with a human being, a human person, and even as with the case on the burial. I mean, why all this reaction to the prospect of a burial, except for the fact that it makes a moral point of treating with dignity the body of the child? So, no, I think that's they're all to be encouraged. I mean, the beating of the heart, courts are striking down that kind of those bills, but most of the public think that, like 60% of people in the surveys think you shouldn't have an abortion when you have the evidence of a beating heart. They don't seem to realize you can get that evidence after about 6.5 weeks. So at a certain point, I hope, we always hope the recognition will kick in is that, you know, it's not that the heart marks the advent of the human being. There was a living entity there that was bringing forth the beating heart. And what do you think? Do you think with an early abortion that you're killing something other than the same being you would kill in a late abortion? So why is it something about the late abortion that makes such a difference to you? You can see the baby, but you shouldn't disguise the fact. Can you really disguise the fact to yourself that you're dealing with the same entity, the same being? Well, I don't know if I've helped this discussion or hindered it, Todd, but you're sweet to invite me back for another discussion here.
Hadley Arkus is Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence in American Institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. He's author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, The Touchstone of Natural Law. You can purchase this book and find out more about the James Wilson Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hadley, thank you very much.
Oh, Todd, thanks so much again for inviting me.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk with Rod Dreher of the American Conservative about the defrocking, we call it the laicizing, of Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.